Welcome to the Ohana Life Podcast, where I try to bring to you people that can help you along your health and wellness journey. In this episode, I was able to interview Judy Miller. I actually work for Judy and her business, which helps nurses try to understand and pass the NCLEX exam. As she helps them prepare for this, it helps them along their journey as being a nurse and helping us in a healthcare situation. Judy has been a nurse for such a long time that I thought it would add so much value to us to understand how nurses were back then, how they are now, what the process is to be a nurse, and maybe what they're dealing with currently during this pandemic. Judy was so nice to take time out of her day to be able to answer all the questions that I had for her. And we even did some practice questions at the end to see if I might have a chance at the NCLEX review. Although I would not be able to take it because I would not have gone through nursing school. So kudos to all of these nurses and doctors who have been helping during this world pandemic right now. And I just thought it would be so nice to have some new knowledge and just understand a little bit about that Western medicine piece. Although Judy does use Eastern medicine quite a bit. So I love that she has great knowledge about both and combines the two in her own life, which is what I try to do as well. So I hope you enjoy this episode. It was really fun to be able to just sit down with Miss Miller because I just love her. All right, enjoy.
Hi, Judy.
Hello.
I wanted to thank you for wanting to do this with me today. I have so much I want to ask you, and I think that will be of value to so many people that I know. So thank you for doing this today.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I'm delighted.
So I'm going to apologize in advance for people that my rooster is crowing, but I think that should be fine. I think it adds that nice enrichment of our farm life here in New Hampshire. So I don't think people know that I work for you. You have a business called Judith Miller NCLEX Review, NTC, Nursing Tutorial and Consulting. And I love working for you, and I love what it is that you do. And I feel like it's such a good compliment to what I know in terms of, like, I love the human body. I, you know, deal with the kids are constantly having something wrong with them. So I always have these aspects of wanting to know things a little bit further. And so working for you just was an instant mesh of kind of what I do, what I know, and an extension of wanting to learn more. So can you maybe tell people a little bit about you and maybe your history of being a nurse and how far back that goes?
A long way. I've been a nurse for a very long time. It's funny. When I was in high school, there were two things I was never going to be: a nurse or a teacher. I wanted to be something different. I guess I was too independent even back in those days. I came from a family of teachers and I wanted to be different. Okay. So, but I was kind of drawn to healthcare. And I applied for and got a job as a nurse's aide, not a candy striper, but a paid nurse's aide at 60 cents an hour in our local hospital. And pretty soon I realized that the things that I thought I couldn't deal with, some of the nastier, dirtier, unpleasant things, that's what nurse's aide did. And I was handling that. And I I fell in love with nursing. And so as a rebellion thing, I chose to go to a university school of nursing. Most of the nurses that I worked with were thrilled that I was going into nursing, but they thought I should go to a diploma school, which was very common back in those days. And I said, nope, I'm going to a university program and get a degree. So that was my teenage rebellion, if you will. And that's, you know, from there, it's been a long history of that. I've been in nursing a long time since then.
So where have you been a nurse? Like maybe what states? And I think you were a nurse in the war, right?
Well, yeah. When I first got out of nursing school, we had to wait months to get our state board results back at that point, at that time. It's better now. So I was a visiting nurse in the city of New Haven, Connecticut. I just loved it. I just love visiting nurse. But I had joined the Army. I had become a part of this Army student nurse program. So that when funds got low, the Army just appeared on the campus and said, hey, sign up, give us some time, and we'll pay for your last 2 years of college. So what a deal. Now, it was in those days, we had no cell phones, we had nothing like that. We had one television in our dorm, and little did I realize that Vietnam was looming. That's why they were aggressively recruiting. But anyway, I did. I went to Fort Sam, Houston in San Antonio, Texas, and went to the basic training for nurses. And then went to a place called Fort Devens in Massachusetts, where they were trained, where there was having a lot of infantry brigade was undergoing training to head off to Vietnam. And then I went to Korea, and my husband was an Army chaplain, and he was in Vietnam, and he was injured, and I was reassigned to be in Vietnam for a while, and he died of his injuries. So I came back to the United States. The Army was very kind. They said, you don't have to stay overseas if you don't want to. And so I didn't. I came back to the United States, and they assigned me to Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. And at Walter Reed Hospital, I spent most of my time there working on the VIP unit. So caring for lots of VIPs, including former president and five-star general Dwight D. Eisenhower, was one of my patients. So I've had a long list of senators and congressmen and cabinet officers and high-ranking military that I cared for in those years there at Walter Reed.
What would they have been in there for?
What would they have been in the hospital for? Oh, well, obviously you don't talk about those kind of privacy issues, even if the people are no longer living. But, well, I guess I could say, you know, Eisenhower had heart attacks and they were there for all kinds of things, whatever illnesses they had, surgeries, medical, surgical, whatever the illness was, we took care of them. It was a small staff. You know, security clearance on that small staff. And if need be, we work 12 hours a day, 10, 12, 15 days in a row. And then when things got better, we got a few days, extra days off. But yeah, that's the way of the Army.
So only Army nurses would be pretty much allowed to have that access to.
Oh, we were all Army nurses. Yes, everybody was Army. They were all Army personnel. The only people that weren't, I think we were all the medical personnel were full-time Army.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you worked there for a while.
Oh yeah, yep. And when I got out of the Army, I worked in a surgical unit for a while. Taking care of, you know, patients, and went back to graduate school and got a master's degree. The Army said they would send me to graduate school, but at that point in time, The Army, if you decided to have a family, that was a medical discharge. And that's not the case today, but it was then. And by the time I ended up getting out of the Army, I was thinking about marrying again and a family and so forth. And so I decided I would go on my own to graduate school. And I did, got a master's degree. I like all of nursing, so I got the most broad master's I could think of, med-surg, and an emphasis on teaching, because I was born, as I said, into a family of teachers, and that has really been a calling for me. And then started teaching in associate degree programs, baccalaureate programs, and have been full-time or part-time doing something teaching nursing the rest of my adult life.
And that's how I've met you, is at this stage. So when you, how long was the university program? Was that a 4-year program?
Oh, yeah.
That was a 4-year program, but you did 2 of them in the military. And then how long was the graduate program?
I was at the same school. I was at the University of Connecticut at the same university. They just paid for it.
Gotcha.
The Army paid for it, but I was at the same school.
Gotcha. So when you graduated the university, was there a specific area of nursing that you were doing, or it was kind of a broad?
Oh, no. When you graduate from an undergraduate program like that, you are a consummate generalist. When new nurses, even today, graduate from their basic program, they have studied all areas of nursing. It's after you, once you get out into the field, then you may decide to specialize in different areas. But I worked in all kinds of areas.
So when you were a nurse helping in the military, in the Army, you were just dealing with whatever came your way. It wasn't like
that's right. Most of the time it was medical surgical floors, various types of medical surgical floors. And then of course the VIP unit in the last couple of years were that was whatever came our way. We were ready for, because we had a very small staff, all security clearance kind of thing for that staff.
Very cool. That's so cool. And then you did med-surg is where you decided to kind of settle.
For a graduate program, I thought long and hard about several different areas. My problem has always been I like too many things. And whatever I'm working in, I can get heart and soul into it and really enjoy it. But I thought med-surg was broader. And so I got my master's in med-surg with an emphasis on teaching.
So what year did you start university? The university program? Do you know?
I don't really want to know that.
Okay. So now you've done this, you finish your graduate program, and then when did you decide to start this business?
Well, I had been teaching an associate degree and then baccalaureate degree programs. And then when I did marry again and had some babies, and I was working part-time and taking care of babies the rest of the time. So one of the, at the university, they called me up and said, we have a student who didn't pass her boards. Could you help her? So, okay. So I tutored her. I worked harder than she did, I think, because I wanted to do everything just right. So I think I spent more hours studying than those early students did. And she passed, and then they said, well, here's another one. And it sort of kind of went on like that. I did some work for another, for a nurse entrepreneur who was doing workshops and all. And then it just became, there was such a demand kind of thing that I just started tutoring and teaching faculty how to write tests and teach students how to take tests and that just kind of grew from there.
So how, when you had your first board, your state board, what was the study process for that? Like how, and how was the test? So you said it took a couple months to get back, but what was the test like for nurses back then?
Way back then, and we're talking decades and decades ago. It was not a computer exam. It was a two-day exam. We had tests, I believe we had a total of six tests over 2 days. There was a test for general subject areas. There was and we sat. I was in the state of Connecticut at the time, and so we sat where the legislators sat. We sat in the state house where they sat at their big table, their desks, and we were properly spaced so that nobody could cheat, of course. And we had a medical exam, a surgical exam, a pediatric exam, an obstetrics exam, and a psychiatric exam. And then there was a test with new questions, tryout questions on it.
Oh, gotcha. Kind of what they do now.
Well, no, it's totally different from what they do now.
I mean the new questions part. The new questions
part. Well, you always have to have some new questions, but the difference is it was a separate test as opposed to integrated throughout the exam as it is today. So you go, now you don't know which question is a new question, a tryout question, and which question really counts. Back then you did.
So when you say you had six tests, is it subjects?
Yes, as I just said, a medical, a surgical, pediatric, maternity or obstetrics, and psychiatric. Okay, and you could pass one, two, three, four, five of them. If you failed one of them, you only had to take one test.
Oh, you only retook that one part. Oh, that's nice.
It's all changed now. We have the computer adaptive testing today, which is a much more efficient way of testing students, graduates. It's a much more efficient way. That exam was very long and laborious, and we had, the little railroad track sheets where you fill in the little tracks, not even bubbles, little tracks kind of thing. So, yeah. And it was, paper and pencil test. We didn't have to write essays, but it was a paper and pencil test.
So let's so you had done your business, you had started tutoring people, and then you decided, I need to now do this on kind of a bigger term, like a bigger scale, and decided to do, were VHS tapes first, or did you have something before that?
No, the first, we had, of course, classes. I had a classroom and classes that I would teach. And first I did some audio recordings, and then I did VHS recordings. The process has become much more sophisticated over the years.
Yes, it has. Because then you went to CDs.
Yeah,
we went DVDs, to DVDs.
Yeah. And the medium has changed over the years.
And now it's streamed. So you took your teachings that you did in a classroom and basically recorded them so that you could touch more of an audience, kind of more nurses.
Right. Yes. They were all studio recorded. Yeah.
So would you say, or would it be safe to say that nurses are extremely necessary, one of the most extremely necessary jobs in the world?
I would think so. And not just because I'm a nurse, but healthcare and the health of the public is very important. If we are to survive as a species, as a country, whatever. Nurses are a major part of that. The role of nurses is constantly expanding, constantly developing, they are, and of course I might be slightly biased, but they are really the backbone of healthcare.
Absolutely. So what's going on now for nurses during COVID and this pandemic? So in terms of, so your role is kind of the helping them pass the NCLEX exam, which is this major exam that they have to pass. It's, would you say that's equivalent to the state board? Is that the same?
Oh, the terms NCLEX and state boards are used interchangeably. The state board exam is really kind of an old fashioned term, because back a long time ago, before I was ever in nursing, each state had their own exam. But by the time I came into nursing, we did have a national exam, but each state didn't have the same passing score. And now we have a national exam that's on the computer. Each state has the same passing score with it. And it's called NCLEX, the National Council Licensure Examination, NCLEX for exam. And so it's truly a national exam, but with state licensure. So state boards, but you'll find that a lot of people still talk about state boards or taking the board exams. Other professions have board exams, and it comes from the Board of Nursing. So you apply to the Board of Nursing for your license in your state, but you also take the NCLEX exam, which is a national exam. That's part of it. That's the testing part is a national exam today.
So your business, what you do now, is to help them understand what's going to be on the test and what the questions are being asked and how to really dissect and discern what the answer might be to help them pass it. Is that correct?
Yeah. I focus on a couple of things. One, reviewing the content. So one, you know what areas are subject to being on the test, but each student, the way the exam is structured today, each candidate, let's not say a student because they're graduates, but each candidate has a unique exam. And but we know there are some guidelines on the things that might well be discussed or asked about on the exam. And so I try to review pretty much everything they've learned during their nursing program. And then I have liberal doses of how to think like an exam writer. I like to help the candidate learn to be able to think like an exam, like a test writer, an item writer, and be able to understand why right answers are right and wrong answers are wrong. So we spend quite a bit of time doing a lot of questions during the reviews and looking at how to parse it, how to take out the keywords, the important words in the question, see what the question is really asking, and then take a look at, you know, why right answers are right and wrong answers are wrong. And you do that enough times, you become good at it. And that's my goal for my students, that they become good at it.
And you're just a natural born teacher. You may have wanted to sway away from it being raised that way, but you're just so good at explaining things. And just whenever someone does take your program, they are very successful on the exam, and to have that worry kind of taken out of the way. How long is the NCLEX exam now? How many questions? How long does it take? It's on the computer, right?
Well, we've got a unique situation going on now. During this COVID time, the exam is shorter than it normally is. And what they have done, and RN and PN exams normally are different lengths. That is not true during this COVID time. That's only good for the next few months, then they'll decide whether to extend it. But what they have done in order to allow for safe testing of candidates, in other words, making sure that the testing centers get properly disinfected, wiped down, et cetera, between candidates who are taking exams, we could not have exams that lasted 6 hours. And some people 6 hours and some people 2 hours, and they couldn't do the proper disinfecting of the centers. So we now have a temporary kind of thing, which will be good for the next few months. Nothing's going to be more than 3 hours. And the number of questions is shorter. What they have also done is there is a what they call next generation NCLEX that people are working on. That was supposed to be implemented in the next couple of years. Then the candidates were asked to take some of those kind of questions to see how they were to get information on that. None of that is happening now. So that stuff is not happening. They're cutting out that to streamline it. Now, if the National Council of State Boards of Nursing is the one that is responsible for NCLEX, they are some of the greatest researchers, testers in the world. They live and die by testing and have many, many psychometricians on their staff. So I feel pretty confident that what they have done, and they've done some research to support that, is adequate. That these nurses that are taking the exam now are not being shortchanged. It makes you wonder, why don't we keep it on permanently? When they first went to the CAT, the computerized adaptive testing, the initial research showed that less than 40 questions they could really determine whether the person candidate is going to pass or fail by selecting questions carefully, and the computer can do that. So, because each question is classified according to difficulty level, and they can move you up and down that sphere. But nobody would think that you could license a nurse on 40 questions. That just was not a good public image. They settled on what they had been doing, but right now it's different. And when they go, I don't know whether they'll go back to the old way or not. We'll see.
So it's different for two reasons. One, they're trying to keep the test shorter for purposes of, you know, infection, but also to get nurses out sooner to the field.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, both things. Now, the getting nurses out sooner to the field, it's interesting because some of the new graduates that I've talked with will tell me that jobs are a little bit hard right now. And part of that had to do with it's the COVID stuff. And hospitals were not getting the revenues because they closed all the revenue centers, mammography centers and outpatient surgery and all of that to focus strictly on the COVID cases. And so they had to fire some nurses. Now that's reversed pretty much. Oh yeah, which makes zero sense.
Right.
But their revenues were down. And so they were overworking the nurses they had. That's turning around now. So that things are getting back on more of an even keel, and they are looking for new nurses. Most hospitals now, many hospitals are really looking for new nurses, and we need them.
We do need them. So this may be a naive question, but can a nurse, if I was working on pediatrics, could I go to the heart floor?
Well,
is it interchangeable like that?
To some extent, it is. Just because you started out in pediatrics doesn't mean you have to stay there forever. You probably would not go from pediatrics to a coronary care unit, however, the ICU part, because there's a lot of advanced specialty training before you can work in an ICU. So if you go to work in a different area, there's a fair amount of orientation to the types of patients, conditions, problems that are consistent with that area. but you can change your career over time. And I wouldn't say, I mean, sometimes you get called to work on a unit that's different than the one you've been working on, and you're expected to be able to do basic nursing care there. And you're expected to have the judgment to know when this is something more specialized on that area and you need to get advice from somebody else if you did that. But you can reinvent yourself as a nurse over and over and over.
But do you have to keep training, or you just kind of work on the floor to understand what they do and then that's it?
Well, let me quote Florence Nightingale. And a quote from her is still very valuable today. Florence Nightingale said, "Let us never consider ourselves finished nurses." And that is true today, that you constantly have to, you have to keep up with the nursing literature. You have to keep up with the new equipment, the new ways of treating, the new treatment protocols. The things, if you stay in nursing as I have for many decades, you will find that facts, things that we call facts decades ago may not be facts today. We learn more. And so one of the most important things is to learn how to think. And if the facts change as the data comes in and we get more and more data, nursing research, medical research, shows new, better ways to do things, whether it's manage diseases or keep patients comfortable and happy and safe and reduce complications. The more you have to be flexible, you have to be able to think it through and say, oh yeah, this one makes sense and this is why, and you apply it. But all of the knowledge that you learned in the beginning may, all those quote facts may be superseded by subsequent research.
Yeah, I mean, they have a hard job because there's so many borders and boundaries in the medical system.
Yeah.
If one wrong move, they can get in trouble. But then you also have to use critical thinking of, does this make sense? Like look at the patient, you know, really understand it's an individual and how can they, you know, discern what may be different.
Critical thinking. I mean, the medicines, some of the medicines that I learned about when I was in nursing school are still in play. There are hundreds, thousands new ones that are not, that were not around decades ago. And that will happen to the nurses today. Things are going to change. But if you can think, you're going to be good at it.
Do you think all nurses have that compassion, that loving compassion for people to be able to take care of them? Or do you think that it's like half and half, some have to just have like a stern boundary to be able to handle what they see?
I don't know statistically. I would not hazard a guess, but I would say that I would hope that the majority of nurses have compassion and are in the profession because they like people and want to be able to improve their lives. Having been around a long time and known a lot of nurses, there are some nurses who you wonder where that compassion is buried. I had a friend once who, a nurse friend who called, referred to refrigerator nurses. They were working to get enough money to buy a new refrigerator. And certainly there are probably people out there who are doing it for that, because it is a pretty stable job. It's one where there, you know, the demand goes up and down. Sometimes we have shortages, sometimes not, but it's something that over the long haul, there's likely to be a demand for.
Yeah, I've always had great success with nurses. They're just so friendly and kind, and they're that great in between, you know, between the admissions office and the doctor, and just make everybody feel pretty great.
We're trying to teach nurses how to be that way.
Well, and I mean, this is why I wanted to do this with you, because you should retire, but you have much compassion for what you do, and you want to just help these nurses be successful to get out there and kind of continue the field that you've been doing. It's just so stellar, and I love working for you.
Well, thank you. One of the things that sometimes I will sit down and indulge myself a bit and think, okay, how many students have I touched over these years, these decades? And then I may sometimes say, and how many patients have they touched?
Yes.
By the concepts that we discussed, that they learned. And then I think, okay, maybe I have made a difference in this world. Mm-hmm.
You have. And that's a great way to live. Such a great way to live. So how do you keep up your teachings? Because you have to really stay on top of like what drugs are off the market, which ones are new, what are some of the new procedures, what are some of the new things that are going to be on the test based on what they do. How do you keep up with all that?
It's a lot of work. I do a lot of reading. I get professional journals, both in print, online, and I really work hard to try and stay on top of it. And it's a constantly changing or developing field, because there's so much that we're making such strides medically, and that affects nursing practice, of course. So yeah, it's hard work. I can't sit around, and I don't sit around and twiddle my thumbs very often.
No, you don't. Do you think that nurses have to do the same, or just by being in the field through experience, they're already continuing to get the new knowledge?
It depends on the nurse, hopefully, and the field. But as in most hospital environments, or let's not just say hospital, most employment environments, because nurses are in many, many different settings. But in most employment settings, a part of it is continuing education. And most states, not all states now, but most states require continuing education for relicensure. And so the number of continuing education units varies from state to state, but most states now require that. Most career ladders in employment areas require continuing education. So it's built into the system that you will continue to learn.
Okay,
whether it's workshops, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, but it's built into the system.
Gotcha. Okay, that's good. I myself just feel like continued education is one of my pillars of living. It's like never stop learning, because there's so much to learn in life. If you don't know, if you think you know everything about one topic, go to another topic, you know?
Absolutely.
That's one of mine. So another thing that I love about you, Judy, is that you are able to take this Western medicine piece and merge it with kind of the Eastern medicine as well. And you do a really good job of kind of blending those two things, like energy, muscle testing, oils. You know, do you want to talk a little bit about how you do that and how you're able to kind of know one is good for one and one is good for the other, even though your background is mostly in Western medicine?
Well, my initial background was Western medicine, but nursing, with its emphasis on the whole person, kind of promotes a much more holistic approach. And so one of the organizations I belong to is the Holistic Nurses Association, the American Holistic Nurses Association. And I do energy work and do work with oils and muscle testing and some of those things, because I really believe that much as Western medicine has had many, many advances, laboratory advances, very many advances, and we have to pay attention to that. We have to learn about that. There is more, and there are more more ways of looking at the world and looking at health and looking at the person than the strict clinical laboratory method of Western medicine. And so I, in my own work with people and patients and all, I do apply that. I do teach a little of that in my review courses. The NCLEX does have some questions in it about alternative. They use still using the term alternative and complementary and alternative medicine. So that gives me a chance to open up and talk about that a little bit more. But yeah, I try to integrate that. Most of the time, people don't even know I'm doing it. But you do integrate it in your approach. I do.
Yeah, like let's talk about, and if you're open to it, one of the things that you do is muscle testing with Denise. And I had Denise on a podcast for the Bridge of Natural Wellness. And, you know, one of the things she found out was that you had Lyme from way back when.
I've had Lyme for 50 years.
50 years. Yeah. And so one would call that chronic Lyme. And you used, obviously, the Western approach, but then you went on to this other approach. And how did that work for you?
Oh, it worked very well. I don't have Lyme anymore. I've had a couple of another bouts of it with new tick bites since that time, but that was easily dealt with using the non-traditional, if you will, approaches. And so there are some things like that, like Lyme, for instance, that the non-traditional approaches are probably more effective than the modern approaches with doxycycline. So yeah, there's some places where that really is definitely more effective. Gotcha. And that's because there's a lot of our ways of being are more than just chemical bonds that we can look at in the laboratory and say this enzyme connects to this enzyme. So that there's more ways of being than just that.
So I thought it would be fun. I don't know how fun this will be, but for you to give me a couple of practice questions that might be on the NCLEX and see how I do. So maybe at least one, maybe we can try one and see like, what is it that nurses have to go through pass this exam? Okay.
I'll do that. It would be a little bit easier if I could hand it to you or let you see it, but let me read it. Let me read you a question.
Okay.
All right. An adult woman has been admitted with myxedema. The nurse makes the following assessment: respirations of 8 per minute, diminished breath sounds in the right lower lobe, crackles in the left lower lobe. Which nursing action is essential because of these findings? And this one has 4 choices. The 4 choices: 1, encourage coughing, turning, and deep breathing. 2, encourage frequent rest periods. 3, initiate postural drainage. Or 4, continue with routine nursing care as this is expected.
Did you say it was myxedema?
Myxedema.
Myxedema, like M-I-X?
M-Y-X.
Oh. Okay, so I'm assuming that's a swelling. Yeah, I know. So seeing it is much better. So I'm going to assume that's swelling. I would think that resting would not help because their respiration is already pretty low. Did you say it was like 8?
8 per minute.
Per minute, yeah. I would think that she wouldn't want to just continue doing what she's doing, although I guess if the vital signs were fine and this person's not in distress. I personally would think that the coughing, repositioning, all that stuff would help to get things moving. But postural changes would work as well. So is this where like there could be two right answers, but one is more correct?
There's only one right answer.
There's definitely a right.
We've got the dilemma that many students have, that they see they've eliminated a couple of answers and they've come down to two answers. Yeah.
So they could do postural changes to promote drainage, but I don't know. I feel like breath fixes a lot of things. So I'm going to go with C, the third one.
Which was initiate postural drainage.
Oh, I'm sorry. The coughing one.
The coughing one was
coffee. Okay. Now,
just listen. You've actually done your, you've actually come, maybe we'll make you a nurse. And what you picked up, you didn't know what mixed edema was, but what you picked up was slow respirations because you knew that 8 was slow. And you, the other things were breathy, diminished breath sounds, crackles. You may not know what crackles are, but it was in the left lower lobe, so you know it probably was in the lung. So those three things are all to do with respiration. And the way to deal with the diminished breath sounds and the crackles and to prevent the crackles from becoming pneumonia is to cough, turn, cough, and deep breathe. Now, myxedema is hypothyroidism. And the edema in myxedema is actually more peripheral edema. It's not in the lungs per se. You had to pick up those details about the respiratory symptoms to do it. Now, it would be easier if you knew, maybe it would be easier. Myxedema, all of these things are fairly common in patients with myxedema, but we have to do something about it. So we wouldn't take the routine care because you don't want this patient with crackles to end up with atelectasis pneumonia. You don't want that. So you did well at thinking about picking up the respiratory terms and a respiratory.
So was the answer the postural changes then?
No, coughing terms.
Oh, it was the coughing term. Okay.
You did well picking up all those respiratory symptoms and taking the thing that would correct those or prevent complications. Now, what caused her to get this stuff is because she's hypothyroid and she doesn't move. So she has too many rest periods and that would make her worse. You've got to be up and moving to keep your lungs clear.
Mm-hmm. I think that everyone should go through this type of critical thinking, whether they're a nurse or not, is to like really think about, because what we have kids, we have grandkids, we have pets, we're constantly wondering, why do I have this pain? Why is this like this? Why do I have this rash, right? So we're constantly thinking of these things. So it would really be nice to deduce, well, it can't be this because of that, and it can't be this because of that. And maybe I should, instead of just us depending on the primary care physicians who may, you know, be overwhelmed in the first place, to just really think about what could this really be? Maybe what did I eat the day before? Or maybe I have too much rest. What if I moved more? Would that help? I love this way of thinking. Just you going through it made so much sense to me.
Very good. Very good.
I wonder, should we try one more? Now, the computer would make this harder for me if it was the cat.
The computer would be much easier for you to see it. Let me see.
Well, if I were doing this on the computer, because it pulls questions that are categorized as harder or, right, the computerized adaptive questions.
Well, on the computer, if you get a question right, your reward is a harder question. Because the computer is always trying to find the level, and each question has been tested, and we know the difficulty level of each question. And so the computer is always trying to find the level above which you miss it, below which you get them all right. Okay. And so it juggles you back and forth with that. So your punishment for missing a question is an easier question.
And that's why they had 75 that they used to have to get right, and now it's 40?
Well, it's different. The 75 was the minimum number of questions. You didn't have to get them, and only 60 of those counted on the exam. The other 15 were the tryout questions, new questions. So of the 60 questions, you had to have, and then we get a cumulative average. So what's the difficulty average? And is your average difficulty of the questions, is that at or above the pass line? And we look at what's the confidence band. So with where is it that there's 95% confidence that you know this material, and you, so there's a lot of statistical stuff that goes into that.
Gotcha.
I'll give you another question if you want.
Let's try it.
I've selected one that doesn't have too many difficult names of diseases in it. The nurse is planning care for the following clients. Which client should be cared for first? So one is a 60-year-old who is 3 days post-op and needs a dressing change and ambulating. Two, a 75-year-old who had a suprapubic prostatectomy, there's the big word, yesterday, says, take that tube out of me right now, I have to pee, end quote. Three, a 90-year-old who had a hip replacement is to ambulate with help today. Or four, a 50-year-old who had abdominal surgery is complaining of pain in the operative area. So who should you go to first?
Gosh, okay, what was the third person? It was a 50-year-old?
A 90-year-old hip replacement was number three. Number one was 60-year-old, 3 days post-op, dressing change, ambulation.
So I guess I don't know what an ambulation is. Does that mean bleeding?
No. Needs a dressing change and needs to ambulate. Ambulate is walk.
Ambulatory and walk. Okay. I don't know this 50-year-old that had abdominal surgery is seems distressing to me that it hurts, but if he just had abdominal surgery and it hurts in the region, it's going to hurt there, I would assume. The 9-year-old.
Well, to help you in your thinking process, one of the key things in that answer choice, abdominal surgery, complaining of pain in the operative area. So pain, as you indicated, pain in the operative area is expected pain. So
exactly.
Keep that in mind. I like questions like this. I like to eliminate some if I can.
Right.
So I think that's what you're doing here.
I feel like the guy that's 75 that feels like he has to pee, who just had the prostatectomy, I feel like he needs to be addressed first, right? Because wouldn't it be great that that means that things are working well and he needs to have that taken out to have that work well? I forget with the hip replacement, the 9-year-old with the hip replacement, what were they complaining of?
Well, she just needs to ambulate today.
Oh, they just wanted to walk.
Well, now she's going to complain when she's walking, but that wasn't part of the question.
Right. I mean, addressing, so I feel like one and two, addressing change is important for sure. So there's no infection, but I also, I don't know, there's something about this 75-year-old that is feeling like they need to pee. I don't know with a tube in if that's a normal feeling or not, but I'm going to go with B.
All right. Well, you get it. Not quite for the right reasons. Okay. I would approach this by eliminating number one that was 3 days post-op, needed a dressing change in ambulation. That doesn't have to be done right now. That can be done in a half an hour. That's fine. And I would also, the ambulation piece, that doesn't have to be done right now. So it said, which one should you go to first? So I'd eliminate those two because of the time factor.
Okay. Yeah.
Just they're out because of the time factor. Now, pain in the operative area, we'd like to keep our patients comfortable, but it is expected pain. Now, number two, which was kind of, that's your ESP kicking in here, Lisa. But the suprapubic prostatectomy, that's an, these, in fact, this patient has two drainage tubes. They have a suprapubic drainage tube that's that goes in through the abdomen into the bladder, draining bloody urine. And they also have an indwelling urinary catheter that goes in through the penis, the urethra, and that's also draining bloody urine. And to me, they sound a bit desperate. Take it out of me right now. I have to pee. Now, one of the reasons, it could simply be because there are big balloons in these catheters. It could just be that the discomfort from the enlarged balloons that keep them lodged in the bladder. Or it could be that there is a clot in one or both of these catheters. Yikes. And that's obstructing the outflow of urine. And this person sounds like they're almost desperate enough to start pulling tubes out. And that would be pretty awful. You have to deflate the balloons before you pull them out. Otherwise, you do a lot of damage to yourself. Okay. So for those kind of reasons, I would choose answer number two.
Yes. Okay. Well, I had it for the wrong reasons, but. Yeah,
we were able to eliminate one and three. Those didn't have to be done now, not mm-hmm. first. And the expected pain, sorry, painful guy, but that can wait. For number two, who could be about to do something very dangerous or they could have a clot, we got to get more data. We got to find out what this feeling is, why they're feeling that way.
So interesting.
So there's lots of thinking through questions.
Yeah.
And when we do reviews, I do this over and over and over. We do lots of questions with each subject area and look at why they're right and why they're wrong. And just like when students are studying, I encourage them all to, when they're doing questions, read the rationales because that's like a whole nother textbook.
And the rationale is basically what we just went through, like why it can't be this and why, yeah, okay.
A good question book has good rationales. Now, there's some out there that just say what the right answer is, but most question books have rationales, and you've got to read them.
Wow. That's so funny that you said ESP. I haven't heard that in a long time. Judy, I want to thank you so much for doing this with me today. I know that you have a lot going on in your life, but I thought it was really important for people to start to understand what nurses go through and how important they are and, you know, what type of testing they go through to get out there to help people as an individual.
Well, thank you. And I've often said that one of the most difficult courses in any college is nursing. And I still believe that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope that those questions were fun for you. They were really fun for me to try to answer. I do wonder if we all had the same thought process or if mine was just individualistic, which is always just a good way to be. So continued learning, continued growth were sort of my takeaways for this. I will put all of the information about Judy and about her business in the show notes so that you can check her out if you need to. We all know somebody that's a nurse. We all know someone that has been in the hospital. And so it's just a great tribute to them at this time. So I love you all. Have the best day.